interview with John L. LaFleur, capital L E, capital F L O R E, newly elected black legislator and veteran leader in black politics in Mobile, July 14th, 1974.
If you would just tell us just about your background and summarize that before we get into any specific questions.
Okay. Well, my background has been one of, I would say, to begin with, of deprivation in the early ages. My mother was a widow. I was 9 months old. My father died. There were five children. And of course, the two oldest boys had to be taken out of school to try to take the place of the father. And my daddy had left a $400 mortgage on the home at the time. Just happened I had a good mother, a real good mother. We had timber resources up in Clark County, Alabama, but you just couldn't sell much timber at that time, not enough to sustain a family. So my mother had to do domestic work considerably.
Did you grow up in Mobile?
Yes, in Mobile and down in Biloxi, Mississippi. I recall when I was 4 years old, about four, a man was lynched down there. And before I was born, two men were lynched out here in Plateau just, several years before I was born. About 4 or 5 miles north of Mobile, 3 or 4 miles north of Mobile. But I do recall hearing this man scream along the Elmland Railroad tracks on Sunday morning when I was a boy, where they were applying hot pokers to his body, and then they finally took his life. He had been guilty of no more than telling a girl he worked on the beach front. We lived at Seashore Campgrounds, 2 miles below Biloxi. I don't know whether, have you been down that way? You know where, if you have, you may know where the lighthouse is on the beach down there. We lived about 2 miles below the lighthouse, but lived in what were the black quarters. Black people had to live in quarters. Of course, that's been recent in Mississippi, in some places of Mississippi, and some places of Alabama. And this lynching, we lived about a quarter of a mile from the railroad, and that's why we could hear the man scream. It's a wooded area between the quarters where the black women lived, who were all domestics. Only women lived in these quarters, and the railroad track. And I recall we, at night, about 11 o'clock, you could see the train, which was then the Crescent Limited. I don't know whether you've heard of the Crescent Limited. It was a train that was operated, it still operates on the Southern now, but through Meridian, I understand, and Birmingham. Well, up until the railroad began this total abandonment of that passenger service, Crescent Limited operated between New Orleans and New York by the way of Mobile, Montgomery, and Atlanta, up through Georgia, South Carolina, North Carolina, Virginia, Washington, and of course the other states, Delaware and New Jersey, into New York. It was an all Pullman train, and I recall the old black mothers, after their day of toil, with sitting on the front, it was the only place where they could get some breeze of these. They weren't tenants, they were long, we lived in long buildings with just, it was a two-room apartment. I think we had two rooms, we might have had but one room for each family, and it could accommodate maybe about 10 or 12 families, women with children, or those without children, in each building. And there were, let's see, 1, 2, 3 buildings. And when this train would pass, we could see reflection of the lights through the wood. And to them, it was a gospel train, because it was an all Pullman train, and it was the rich people's train. Of course, back in that day, blacks couldn't ride in Pullman cars. In fact, not until the 1940s were we able to do an extensive riding in Pullman cars. It's an interesting story. Of course, I mean, the struggle for and the change that has been experienced in the different eras, E-R-A-S is what I'm trying to say, a change which young blacks who have just come on the scene do not fully appreciate, because they don't know anything about being denied toilet service. If you drive up to a service station, they don't know anything about having to go around the back door to get a hamburger, if you got one at all. So those who've come along the last 10 or 15 years can't realize what the rest of us have endured, and as a consequence, they have very little appreciation, as I told one of you gentlemen talking to you over the phone, of the struggle their elders have made. They know nothing about riding up in a Jim Crow coach, or senders would pour in on you because you were sitting up front and there were no screens to your windows. Well, you had to go up to the front of the car to a water cooler to press a spigot, get water, to put on a towel, to wash your face. They don't know anything about that. They don't know anything about sitting over the hot motor of an intercity bus. That was the only seat that you could occupy. That seat was across the width of the bus in the back, and you were right over the motor. In summertime, you were in such places, Hades, you caught it when you rode that bus. And despite the fact that there was just one person sitting maybe in a seat, for the rest of the distance up the length of the bus, you just couldn't occupy any of those seats. And there's so many things they don't know anything about. They know very little about lynchings. I have a picture of four people who were lynched in Monroe, Georgia. The lynching I covered on July 26, 1946. And Monroe is just 26 miles from Atlanta. And there was one time in my civil rights work that I was a little afraid when I went into Monroe. And then I also investigated the lynching of Willie McGowan down at Wiggins, Mississippi.
In what capacity were you investigating that?
1946, I was connected with NAACP. Then I was also working for a Metropolitan newspaper. I wrote a citation for the newspaper for covering the Georgia lynching.
What paper was it?
Chicago Defender. I was connected with NAACP up through 1956 in a very active way. When John Patterson, who was then Attorney General of Alabama, put us under an injunction in Alabama, we had to cease operation until 1964. And then NAACP came back in 1964. I just didn't become as active as I had been because of a misunderstanding with one of the paid members of the staff. And of course, all my time was free. And I estimate that I gave about $250,000 worth of free time to the NAACP. I covered most of their investigations of railroad service in the South, bus service. Very often, I recall I had to ride a bus from Tallahassee from Jacksonville to the Funiac Springs, Florida, and there were no toilet facilities for blacks. Bus stations back in that day were generally in drugstores. The bus companies didn't have their own passenger stations, with the exception of terminals like Mobile, in intermediate areas, with few exceptions. And I worked for the Chicago Defender and for the Pittsburgh Courier for 10 years. that and my postal, along with my postal salary, enabled me to put my kids through college. I was getting $225 a month in travel expenses. My newspaper work didn't interfere with my postal work because both of those papers were weeklies. And with the defender having a deadline for Mondays, and I was off at the post office on Saturday, and I fly up to Georgia or almost anywhere else that was within reasonable distance that was long back to get back to Mobile for Monday morning. And I was set most of my story with my Western Union Press Service. But I imagine you primarily interested in my background. I went to college here, junior college at night. I had to. Then I took extension work with the University of Chicago at the time that Dr. Hutchins was there. And other than taking that and taking some extension work from Columbia University, at the time that they offered extension courses, that was the extent of my college background. I've never stopped reading. I've continued to read to try to keep informed. And I have a very serious interest in political science. I did take a course in that also.
How active did you help establish the Nonpartisan Voters League of Mobile?
Yes, I did. In fact, I helped to found the NAACP here when I was a teenager in the 20s. Ku Klux Klan was running rampant not only in Alabama but almost all over the United States during the post-World War I period. It was organized primarily at that time for the purpose of trying to return blacks to their previous status that they had before World War I. And we had an agrarian society in the South. We had and most of the blacks came from the rural areas who were drafted into the military services, who came into towns to work in plants, and who went up north. And at that time, they had a number of camp getaway clubs, which meant that it was a misnomer that was used for people who were apprentice transportation to go north. It was a part of the migration of blacks that probably helped to change the political complexion of blacks in the north. And we founded the NAACP in 1925.
And how about the Voters League?
Okay, the Voters League became the political arm of the NAACP at the time that I was actively identified with the NAACP. The NAACP as such was not supposed to be involved in politics. When the NAACP was put under an injunction in 1956 by John Patterson, state of Alabama, and because of the fame that Dr. King had been projected into as in view of the Montgomery bus situation. Almost every minister felt that through some miraculous power that he was endowed with the prerequisites for leadership in a field that was non-religious. And we felt, and we could. It was obvious to us they were making a lot of mistakes. They were making a lot of faux pas right here in Mobile in their leadership. So we made the Nonpartisan Voters League a civil rights organization after the NAACP was put under an injunction in 56. It was the Nonpartisan Voters League that filed the Bernie Mae Davis suit, school suit here. It was the Nonpartisan Voters League that succeeded in getting Vivian Malone at the University of Alabama.
But it was organized in 56, or it was organized before then?
No, it was organized before then as a political arm of the NAACP. But after 56, we decided to make it a civil rights organization because we felt that civil rights was not being given the right direction here by those who had taken over and who were capitalizing on the fact that the NAACP was under an injunction, who had taken over the civil rights movement here.
Was it, how far back did the Voters League, does it go?
The Voters League is more than 25 years old. The Voters League was founded about 1948.
How potent do you consider it now, today?
Well, I think in the last election, it was a deciding factor in the nomination of Tom Purvis for sheriff here, and a change in the in that particular office. I think it was potent in a number of areas. I think it helped to give me the vote that I gained, and also that Gary Cooper gained over Ms. Eddington. We didn't wish to, in that particular race, Ms. Eddington happens to be white. We wanted to double endorse, but we can well understand what white people are up against when they have a sense of fairness toward blacks, for fear that the people who probably don't think with, and what we would class a sober, with a sober direction, and you know how they can rabble rouse, and we were just a little pusillanimous there. We endorsed only Gary, and he admits now that he felt that was the reason he won. Although, if you notice that statistical information sent here by a Board of Education project, his district is more than 65% black, but it did not necessarily mean that you had the people who voted were mainly black, were largely black. I would think you had a few more white voters than you had black voters in the area. But Gary did conduct a voter registration campaign, and he did have some white support, and he attributes his victory by less than 500 votes over Ms. Eddington to the support that the Nonpartisan Voters League gave him.
Is any affiliation between the Nonpartisan Voters League of Mobile and the Alabama Democratic Conference?
No, we operate independently. We do try to cooperate wherever possible. I am a member of the Alabama Democratic Conference, and we don't support all the candidates that the Alabama Democratic Conference supports.
Even on the state level?
No, we don't. But almost, I would say in most instances we do, but not, we don't just let them give us a blanket order or anything of that sort. Do we blindly let them influence us? We get the candidates here. We question the candidates ourselves.
Including the statewide candidates?
Yes, sir. We question Jared Beasley, we question Creel, we question Charles Wood, we question all of them. And the questions that we ask, I imagine, they similar to what any other citizen of Alabama would ask. And there's, of course, in some areas we must ask about their racial viewpoints and how do they stand on certain issues that specifically would affect black people. Now, we do it without any arrogance, anything of that sort. We do it just as we are talking here now. We support Charles Wood as an example in the lieutenant governor's race. I'm not quite certain they supported Charles Wood. I think they supported Jared Beasley. I think they did in the last race, in the runoff. Charles Woods did carry Mobile County. How much we contributed to it, I haven't been able to get the figures as yet to see how the black vote was. But I think most of the black voters did support Charles Wood.
Have you supported any local Republicans?
Yes, we've rather consistently supported Jack Evans, rather consistently.
How about
even on double endorsements at times, when there were black candidates running, such as Noble Beasley, who headed up the Nile Group, Neighborhood Organized Workers, who was running for Congress. We double endorsed in that. In fact, we supported all three of the candidates. Jack Edwards, John Tyson, who was running on the Democratic ticket, and Nover Beasley. Now, frankly, we didn't wish to support Mr. Beasley because for certain reasons that we felt were not in the best interest of the community. But again, maybe that was, we were a little cowardly there, that we put the black man on the ballot when we didn't, when we, against our conscience.
What is the meaning and the value of a double endorsement?
The double endorsement merely gives the place, it gives us a way out. It's almost like Pontius Pilate.
It's when you have a black and a white on the ticket? Or
no,
you
no,
have,
no.
You have two people that you want to endorse?
Yes.
And sometimes you have no endorsement, right?
Yes.
I didn't mean to interrupt you. How's it like Pontius?
Yeah. Well, we call ourselves, in giving a double endorsement, either letting them know that either of the candidates would be acceptable to us as far as our viewpoints are concerned, and that the candidates were just about even insofar as what they stood for was involved.
Does it confuse voters?
It does some, and others just go on and make a choice. And I think almost all organizations do that. We noticed the labor ballot, it was the same way.
How much coordination is it between the Voters League and labor?
We, in most instances, we support candidates that are supported by labor, with the exception of the fact that labor went for George Wallace and we couldn't do that for governor.
Did labor statewide go for Wallace?
Yes. And of course, we couldn't do it.
What would it take you? What would it take to make you vote for George Wallace?
For Mr. Wallace to give definite assurances that he has made a change in his racial attitude. You see, all that you have from Mr. Wallace so far is what you've gotten from him before. Some ambiguity with his expressions that could be interpreted, whatever he says could be interpreted one way or the other. And in our judgment, Mr. Wallace is a Machiavellian politician. He's an opportunist, and we feel that he continues to be that way. There's been no significant change in Mr. Wallace's attitude on the race question as far as we can see. Yet go to court to force him to employ black state troopers. I'm in Montgomery once a month. I'm connected with the Alabama Council for Voluntary Family Planning, the Alabama Council for Comprehensive Health Planning, connected with the Advisory Committee to the Commission on Civil Rights. I'm on the subcommittee for the Alabama State Bar studying prisons, and I'm up there every month. And you go through the state capitol, and black employers are still as scarce as hen teeth up there. And the man has made no significant change as far as we can see. And we can't get elated like some of the blacks, like Charles Evers as an example. Ford, now we can understand why Giant Ford is that way. He's the mayor of a city, and he's looking for some help from Mr. Wallace.
How do you feel about Evers, though?
Well, I'm a little disappointed about Evers' position in this instance.
Or do you feel Ford is more understandable?
No, Evers has joined Ford in the position that Wallace would better.
I know, but I say you say that Ford's position is more understandable to you for Ford to take that position.
Well, yes, it's more understandable, but I don't agree with it. You see, because Ford is looking for some help from Wallace with his various projects for Tuskegee. But Charles Evers is over in Mississippi, and Charles Evers, of course, cannot expect to get any help from Wallace, as I said. Now, I don't know just why he's taking the position without giving a full explanation to the public as to why he assumed that that kind of position.
When you got started in this business, there was just basically one civil rights organization,
that was
NAACP.
Yes, right. That was NAACP.
Now that has a political arm here, plus you've got the Democratic
Alabama Democratic Conference.
And the MDPA.
And then you have Oswald Billingsley has a group that he calls the Democratic something, yet it doesn't have much potency. But he supported George Wallace too, with his group. Now how large his membership is, I don't know. But I know it doesn't compare with ABC.
Well, my question was, with that proliferation of groups, all representing blacks, do you think there's a tendency to, for black unity to split on the political candidates?
I would say in some instances, but I would feel...
Are you more unified now than, say, 10 years ago, or less?
I would believe that there's perhaps less unity now.
You think that's a healthy thing?
No, I don't think so. But I think it's a normal thing for human beings to be that way. As their strength increases, it's normal. It's a normal pattern.
Where do you think it's going to go in the future?
I'm hoping that there will be there wasn't any unity among blacks. When I ran for the Senate, there was no unity. Many of your leading blacks didn't support me. They supported Senator Sparkman. Now, I retained a very cordial relationship with Senator Sparkman. I did not try to inflame the black public against Senator Sparkman. Mr. Cooper, the mayor of Pritchett, in the May primary that year, attempted to inflame black people against Sparkman because he was supporting someone else for the senatorial nomination. And he used the same kind of an appeal that I agree would involve demagoguery. He said that Sparkman voted for the Southern Manifesto, and that he had voted against all civil rights legislation, and he couldn't see how any black person, he was actually hitting at Joe Reed, head of the Alabama Democratic Conference, because Reed was lock, stock, and barrel for Sparkman. And of course, we supported Sparkman. The very fact that we supported Sparkman, again, the potency of our vote was shown, the nonpartisan Voters League vote. Now, I'm not going to tell you it reflects itself that way all the time. It doesn't. But Senator Sparkman won over Melvin Till Allen by perhaps 2,000 votes. I mean, he had just about 2,000 or 3,000 votes more than would have been necessary to keep him from to avoid a runoff with Melvin Till Allen. And we furnished him, the blacks in Mobile County, furnished him about 6,000 votes.
You ran against him during the general election, right?
Yes.
Why did you run in that race?
Now, the NDPA group was a group that, in my judgment, by and large, was a little to the left. It was a little to the left down here, quite a bit to the left. Almost all the people who supported the NDPA in this area were so-called black power people. And with that connotation would go the people who say, damn the honky and damn the black middle class, as they call them, the Onkatongs, et cetera, et cetera. I suspect that Dr. Cashin felt that since I represented a moderate position, and it was unlikely that one of the so-called black militants could make a reflection of strength in Alabama, that he chose this individual because I was regarded as a moderate. And regardless of who may have run on the NDPA ticket, the black political hierarchy in Alabama was solidly lined up behind Senator Sparkman. It was rather ironical that the same Jay Cooper, mayor of Pritchett, who in the May primary denounced Senator Sparkman, for what he classes his racist policies, turned against me in October, and supported the Sanchez Department. And again, it was a case of, in my judgment, of Machiavellian politics. That's
who was Mayor Cooper supporting in that first primary?
He was supporting Robert Eddington, a local attorney who was seeking the Democratic nomination. So it looks like,
Why did you agree to run, though?
Well, it was actually forced on me, and I accepted it. I didn't seek it.
But what was your objective in running?
What was my objective? Well, there I had been told, and I knew it didn't, and I try to be a pragmatist about my politics, but I was influenced by that branch among the blacks, or that group among the blacks, who said there was an outside chance of winning. I had felt, because of my civil rights record, which I thought was very well known, not only in Alabama, but throughout the South, that blacks would rally to your support. I felt, because I'm moderate in my viewpoints, that I could have corralled maybe about 10 or 15% white vote. And though the political strategists who induced me to run had figured it that way, and to me it seemed rather reasonable that if the white vote was split right down the center between Sparkman and Blunt, and I could hold the black vote and get about a 10 or 15% white vote, that there was an outside chance of winning. Of course, I got into the race.
And Mark, I've heard that, and I haven't actually studied it, but you've seen them, but I understand that actually some of the Sparkman got about 5 or 6 times as much black vote as you got. That it was sort of perceived as a power play between Joe Reed and Dr. Cashin, as to which one had the most organization.
No, it was this, I believe, more than anything else. I think it was who had which one of the senatorial candidates had the most money. Dr. Cashin, then NDPA, spent no more than about $6,000 or $7,000 in my campaign, statewide. Now that includes, I'm trying to include all the literature and everything else they put out. They sent down here, I had about $3,000 or $4,000, and I had traveled all over the state of Alabama. We didn't have the newspaper ads, we didn't have the TV presentation or anything else that any of the other candidates had. We didn't have the teamwork in the average black community that the Sparkman people had. I think Mr. Reed, people like that, had this thing well organized, with ADC having groups in almost any large city in Alabama, and many of the smaller communities. They were able to retain the black vote. One thing I learned out of it, black people, like most folk, they don't give a darn about how much you do for them. That doesn't always give you the kind of charisma that you would need in order to win an election.
Was that the first time you'd run?
Yes.
For office? Uh-huh. Did it prove to be valuable when you ran this time for the legislature?
Yes, it was valuable then. I made a number of contacts. I met a lot of people throughout the state of Alabama. I think I made some new friends. It was a novel experience.
Your legislative district is what percentage black?
About 98%.
Did you have opposition?
Yes. My opposition was the brother of the Pritchett City Councilman, John Langham. And
Is there any other black in Alabama politics that's been involved there in as long as you have and still active?
Let me see. Arthur Shores, I believe.
Is he a candidate for something?
Yeah, Shores is on the city council of Birmingham.
But in all those years that you've been involved, what are the major changes you've seen, political changes?
The major political changes, I think I mentioned to you, gentlemen, when I talked with you this morning, that up until 1944, blacks voted very little in Alabama, very little. Let me take Mobile as an example. We had only about 400 or 500 black voters here. And then there was always the apprehension that you weren't going to be permitted to vote. They'd let you vote in some of the elections when they felt like, and others, they just wouldn't let you vote.
But how many black voters now in Mobile?
I would say that we comprise about 20%. You see, what they tell you, we don't keep voter registration statistics on the basis of race. Of course, we don't believe that. We know that. I know what I would do if I were down there, just for the matter of keeping a record. I would certainly have some method by which I could tell white or black applicants, tell the cards of white or black applicants, and I know they have perhaps far more sense than I about doing that kind of thing. I would say about 20% of the people who vote in Mobile County are black. We have a total registration in Mobile County of, I think the registration is around 160,000. And,
so it'll be around 30.
But has that been the basic change, the absolute increase in the number of black voters in the last 20, 30 years?
The last 20, 30 years, with the increase in the number of black voters, I think I told you, told one of you gentlemen, who did I talk to? Okay, when I talked to you over the phone, that you had what was known as a Democratic white primary, which meant it was a white man's primary. Occasionally we'd let you vote, and that was the way the political oligarchy looked at it. We'd let you vote sometime, and again we wouldn't. On this occasion, rather consistently in the early 40s, they didn't let us vote. Then Life magazine, through Thurgood Marshall, sent some photographers in here for the May primary. 1944. And the same year you got the ruling in Smith versus Allwright by the Supreme Court, Texas white primary case. We told these photographers what time we would appear at the polling places. They came in a day ahead of time. We told them what time we would appear the next day at the voting booths. And the photographers were there. We were, the old 7th Ward then was a predominantly black ward. And they were there to see deputies with outstretched arms, keeping three of us, Professor Powell, Mr. Rivers, and me, from coming in. And they got pictures of that. They were in the 5th Ward, down the bay, to see blacks being barred. They got pictures of that. There were 4 wards from which they had pictures, of which they had pictures. And of course there was a big story written about it. That afternoon, after the polling places had closed, we had 12 affidavits that were made up in our office and submitted to Thurgood Marshall in New York. And he in turn went down to Washington and submitted them to Francis Biddle, who was then Attorney General. Mr. Biddle promised to criminally prosecute the Democratic State Executive Committee in Alabama, which was then headed by Gessner McCarvey, Mobilean, who was an avowed Dixiecrat. And Mr. Roosevelt died at Warm Springs, Georgia. And of course, with the change of it, change in the presidency, Mr. Truman brought his own attorney general in, as you know, Mr. Tom Clark. And Mr. Clark, Mr. Marshall, Thurgood Marshall, kept pressure on the Department of Justice. And Mr. Clark decided that he would try to give these people a chance to adjust this question without criminal proceedings. And as a consequence of Mr. Clark's influence in that particular, Mr. Gessner McCarvey called the State Democratic Executive Committee into a special meeting in Montgomery on January 12, 1946, and let the bars down and remove the white primary. But that same Gessner McCarvey, almost immediately after that, began a campaign for another prohibitive measure, which was known as the Boswell Amendment. And this amendment would set up very restrictive intelligence requirements in order to vote. And the boards of registrars would have arbitrary power to determine who could or could or who could not vote. And as a consequence, very few blacks were able to register to vote. And this was attacked while we were getting ready to attack it. The Voters and Veterans League of Mobile attacked it, and it was declared unconstitutional. And then after that, well, even before that, it was amazing to see blacks standing in line a half a block and a block long with that retroactive poll tax feature involved, where some of them paid as much as $48 in back poll tax to see them standing in line to register. And today, young blacks don't seem to take that much interest in registry. When that was declared unconstitutional, you had a rash of registration among blacks. I think we registered in the course of 3 weeks of 1,500 new voters. And that was about 1950. And as a consequence, you were able to swell the black voter registration. That brought on changes in city government. We brought in some new men in city government. The black vote was a deciding factor in the election of Joe Lanham. You haven't talked to him since you've been here. Mr. Joe Lanham has been the most humanistic candidate. Political office holder that we've had, probably anywhere in Alabama.
Mayor?
Yes. Joe Langan, the black area didn't have any paved, but one or two paved streets. He paved streets. He's responsible for black police officers being put on. And of course, we kept pressing him for these things. He made black appointments in other areas that I just can't remember right now, but it was very significant to have some black police officers put on back in the early 50s. We had, there was a question of bus service. They did not effectively enforce these segregation ordinance on buses. And we tried to get them. This was a completely new city regime in 1953. We tried to get them to voluntarily remove segregation from the buses, but they thought it would be politically unwise. And they suggested that we would go to court to have it done, but we were going to court anyway, which we did. Joe Langan, L-E-N-G-E-N, the Negro, the black councilman in Pritchett is Joe Langham. His brother, George Langham, was my opponent. George Langham was a guidance counselor at a school in the Tonaville area. But I recall when we filed a petition asking...
But the one you're talking about is the former mayor.
Yes.
Spells it the same way?
No, spell the same way. What'd you say?
Did he spell it the same way?
No, L-E-N-G-E-N is the former mayor.
L-A-N.
L-E-N-G-H-A-M is the black councilman.
L-A-N-G-A-N. It's the...
It's the mayor, yes.
L-A-N-G-H-A-M.
And is the black councilman in Pritchett. Joe Langan, we did a lot of research in law, and we came up with a number of court rulings to support our contention that the public library should be desegregated. And, of course, we filed a petition signed by 12 citizens asking for desegregation of it. We didn't direct it to the library board. We directed it to the city commission. And Mr. Langham took it to the library board himself and urged them to desegregate the public library system, which saved us maybe $1,000 in legal fees. The same thing happened with regard to parks and playgrounds. We filed a petition asking for desegregation of parks and playgrounds, and that same policy prevailed. We didn't have to go to court in either one of those two instances. We did go to court with regard to city buses and with regard to segregation at the municipal airport. But it so happened that the federal judge here at that time, Judge Thomas, sat on the cases so long that by the time he ruled, these questions had become moot because the city was not enforcing segregation ordinance in either instance. So those are some of the changes that we've witnessed. And today, you have blacks who are working in City Hall. We still have another suit that primarily affects the county. County departments with a job discrimination suit that we filed year before last. We have a consent agreement, a consent decree in that case, and it has not been effective, so we are going back to court. But you do have blacks working in the courthouse, in the tax assessor's office as clerks, and also working in the matter of making land surveys. You have them in the juvenile court. One black girl is in attendance.